Parkcast, the UK's original theme park podcast.
Welcome back to Parkcast, Park fans. We're a podcast for theme park fans. If that is you, if you are entering your theme park nerd era, you have found the right place. We're here every week just chatting about things going on in the theme park industry, particularly in the UK, but looking overseas as well. And as always, just our opinions when we say things. If you disagree with them, feel free to comment and let us know what you think and what we've said wrong. I'm Bex, this is Kev.
Hi, everyone.
And Kip Hakes is with us as well.
Hello.
And today we are very excited to be bringing back a UK theme park legend for, I think, his first interview, actually, in quite a few years. The man needs no introduction, but I'm going to do it anyway. It's Francis Jackson.
G'day, folks.
G'day.
Great to be with you
Hi,
today.
Hi, Francis.
Hey, Kev. Hey, Kip.
Hey, man.
Hello.
Thanks, Rebecca, for having me.
You are very welcome. I say we're bringing you back to the UK. You are actually currently still down under.
I am.
Have we sort
living
of...
Living the life large in the sun.
Not that we're jealous at all. Is it like 10 p.m., 11 p.m. where you are when we're recording this?
It's only early doors now. It's only 7:30 at my time.
Okay, good. Not disturbing you too much. Well, thank you for coming and joining us on Parkcast. I really wanted to get you on. Now, we have done a lot of episodes recently where we have been, in our enthusiast ways, slightly critical of some of the decisions that we've seen going on in UK theme parks. I mean, it's what we do. We're enthusiasts. We like to chat about this kind of stuff. And, you know, we get people saying that we are saying the wrong things or we don't understand. So I thought, why don't we find someone who really does understand? And who better than Francis, who, if for some reason you're not already aware, when he was most recently in the UK, was the general manager at Alton Towers, and before that, the operations director there. But you had a long history in other things before you got to Alton Towers, so I want to obviously get onto all things theme park operations, because you can really give us some interesting insight there. But before we do that, just talk to me about how you ended up there, because you weren't you in ski resorts or something like that?
So I had a long time and a long tenure within the ski industry or the mountain resorts industry, and that took me everywhere: Australia, Europe, specifically in Austria. I've been to Japan, the US, and throughout that time, you know, what really got me started was everything around customer service. You know, most of the time I've been customer service facing roles, and that's basically the industry and everything about the experience that the guest has when they're within your care. And so throughout my time, I moved through various roles, and in the last role that I was within the ski industry as the general manager was a resort in Australia, and Merlin had acquired us, Merlin Entertainments, along with a number of other attractions, aquariums, treetop walks, and two ski resorts. And through that period of time, Merlin came to look for somebody to come and run the operations at Alton Towers. So I took on the role of operations director post the incident. And subsequently, and in my time when I finished up there, I was the general manager reporting through into the managing director of theme park division for Merlin.
Were you a bit of a theme park nerd before that, or was this all brand new? Were you like, oh, I don't know about going and working in a theme park. That's not really my thing.
It was a bit new. I mean, the same thing applies. You know, you've got throughput capacities. You're looking after people. You've got lots of people under your care throughout the time. It was just, for me, it was what I would really call, it was just a different format. And so it was more entertainment. It was less sport. It was less rec. But the same principles really applied. Safety was critical. Guest services was paramount. And dealing with large footfall environments. But yeah, theme parks, it took me a while to learn some of the nuances associated with it.
Did you have to do some research on Alton Towers? That, did you have to go online and have a look at it, or did you fly over to the UK and get a feel for it?
During the interview process, I came across, and it started to dawn on me where Alton sat. You know, it's in the heart and minds of everyone in the UK. It's where everyone aspires to go and take their children, and it was the soul of the company for Merlin Entertainments, was or the queen, I would call it, of the attractions that Merlin owned. And every person who was British, who was living near where I was back in Australia, came out of the woodwork and told me about their experiences with Alton Towers before I'd left to come over. So it became very clear to me straight away the significance of what Alton Towers meant to everyone here in the UK.
Yeah, we talk about that a lot and just say there is, you know, for all its faults, you know, which I'm sure, you know, we've talked about on this podcast before, there's nothing quite like the feeling of walking through the gates at Alton Towers and seeing Tower Street and seeing Alton Towers in the background. There's no theme park really that compares to that.
There isn't, and the setting. There isn't a theme park with the same setting. I mean, you're in 550 hectares of beautiful gardens. There's something like 27,000 trees on the land. I mean, there isn't a setting like that. And that's what makes it in part very unique. It's full of so many childhood memories of many, many families within the country that everyone holds dear to their heart. And it's even seen part of the monarchy be there at various times, various openings. So, yeah, it's definitely it's a very special place.
So you arrived there, obviously, after the Smiler incident. You were taken on the role of operations director. You were, like, new to the UK. You were new to theme parks. It must have seemed like, well, I've got a big challenge, like, on my hands here. Where do I even start?
Absolutely. There was a lot of challenges. I mean, for me personally, there was a lot of development that had to happen. The scale and the size, plus the challenge ahead. The adoption of a very strong safety-based culture. Also saw a new health and safety director come into the business as well. And the business was, as you can imagine, in a lot of turmoil and challenged by what had just happened. And people spend in their careers a lot of time at Alton Towers, and it had really impacted not just the guests but also the staff. There's a lot of people affected by that. And so for myself in that personal development, walking almost gingerly through an environment, but with an impending need to make change quickly. And I personally wasn't just the only one in that space. We had a lot of support from the group to make that change. But I was definitely held as part of a figurehead for that. But it takes a collective team. It takes the might of everybody, the will of everybody, and the focus. And it takes a lot of leadership to bring everyone together. And it takes a lot more time than people would probably give it credit for. It takes to bring everyone and keep everyone on that straight and narrow. And it changes you. It's like I think personal tragedy changes everybody if you look into family units. So the same thing happens within business units as well in places like this, where passion runs deep from the workforce and also your guest about the brand and places where people work. So very interesting challenge for myself to be part of that.
Definitely a challenging time. And I think a lot of people appreciated, I think at the time, that there was someone who was stepping in front of the camera almost and having to put themselves out there, you know, to talk about, you know, safety as it is paramount in our parks. And I think after that, I think there was this trust starting to build back up again. Did you feel that, Francis, within within Alton or Merlin in particular?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a bold move for Merlin to take that step and be comfortable with that step, for the site, for to have an individual within the business step forward and be in that space as well and start to talking. But evidenced by the fact that wherever I walked on park, you know, people would always come and talk to me all the time. And so we tried to humanize it and put a reality to it that there were people behind the scenes and we were genuinely trying to make change and we wanted that. And for a long time there, we were being steered almost by perception rather than reality. It was very, very hard, particularly in the clickbait world where people would take a photo of arriving upside down and say it had stopped, but that wasn't where the ride had stopped. We were really challenged trying to make change. There was a lot of detraction from that space to try and allow us to showcase what we were doing, how we were doing it. So, but it didn't, we never wavered from the task at hand, and there was a lot of hard work, countless days and nights going into making that change.
Do you think it's important for theme parks to sort of have almost like a public face like you were, to sort of give a bit of sort of reasoning to things that have happened and to sort of be held accountable when things haven't gone right? Because it did seem like quite a shift for that to happen. But since you've gone, there hasn't really been much of that. And I think it is missed. But is that, do you think that's a sort of corporate thing and they thought, oh, probably not a good idea, or do you think it's something else?
I think in part it's got to do with your branding, and I think really, I mean, in that space, I think what you would like is the brand to be front and present rather than an individual. I think that's really important, and I think in those moments is when you want to step forward. It's like, I guess, you got that balance between your local pub with a publican that you may know versus it's called a chain pub, a branded. Like you got your Marston's or you pick a name, and you don't really know the people behind it. They're just going through the motions of that. And so I think that depends, if you're part of a large business like that, I think I would rather have it that the brand steps forward and the brand allows for the guests to immerse themselves within the experience, particularly in a theme park as opposed to an amusement park. And I think I would rather let people just fall into that space and allow themselves to remove themselves away from the daily drudgery of life and just feel like part of it rather than have a branded name. But in this instance, it was critical that we put a face to it. So happy you got me.
And are we so glad about that? I mean, your videos were legendary. You're still a legend amongst theme park enthusiasts for those videos. And I think there was a time, probably as you were arriving on park, that as enthusiasts, we were worried that the park would never be the same again. I think what you did worked because it, not that it was ever forgotten and it's still not forgotten, but everyone moved forward. And I think you did help with that, and we were able to go back to Alton Towers and enjoy it in a way that I think some of us were probably worried we would never be able to enjoy it again.
What a time, huh? What a time that was.
It was. And I want to talk more generally about theme park operations because this is your bread and butter. This is what you do. I know you're still a consultant in the attractions industry for this stuff, and we have spoken out quite a lot about our impression of theme park operations and the shaky start that a lot of parks have had, or the decisions that they've made over the last year and into the 2025 season. We've been quite vocal in questioning some of those decisions, and it could well be that we just don't understand it to the extent that we should, or that you do. So obviously, we're going to probably talk about your time at Alton Towers as we go through this, because that's naturally where your experience lies. But I just kind of wanted to do it more generally. So it's not all specifically about Alton Towers. This is to theme parks in general. So we can get some of our questions answered and try and get a better of understanding of how these things work and why things sometimes don't work in the way that we would like them to. So there's been a lot of talk this season about rides and attractions not being open. Let's go first with open on opening day. So this is not just a day-to-day breakdown. Could you explain to us maybe why a theme park at the end of a closed season, at the start of a new season, can't have all of its attractions maybe up and ready to go?
Yes, I can. It's probably one of our most exciting days and one of our most terrifying days is the D-Day. It's
Really?
the first day. And then what is first day, because some places will have, but those that operate seasonally, all right, have a stop start versus those that run all year round. All right. So I'm not just talking specifically about the UK. So parks that run all year, right, bring rides down and through a controlled manner throughout seasonal timings and then bring them back to life after they've done their annuals. Whereas what parks who run seasonally try and do is cram all of that work into a closed period. And therein lies part of the real challenge that you face. And also, you can't get away from the fact that weather also plays a small part, but there's some really big factors here. And to your point, like at the end of the day, having awareness and knowledge around it, I think is useful. But when you have paying customers, when your guests are paying, they're not really, it's not really for them to know about your woes and your challenges. What they're paying you to do is to have those rides available when they come on site because you've told everybody you're going to get open. So there's a number of challenges here, and I'll go into detail right it, but there's a lot of things, and I've thought about how I explain this really well. So I've broken it down to a number of parts. So when you've got your technical or your ride maintenance, you've got your operations, you've got your guest experience component, and there's some strategic factors that play into all of this. And I want to talk about it in two parts. One of that, is sort of new rides, and then you've got sort of age rides. And to sort of set the context here, when I talk about age rides, when I finished, if I started at Alton Towers back in 2000 and what was that, 16, and what are we now, 2025? So that's 9 years. So all of those rides at Alton Towers that haven't been removed, that are still there today, are now 9 years older. And or when I left, in 2013, so everything's now 3 years older from when I left. And when you sum up the total of all the rides, you can see how the average age of the assets, as we call it, is aging. All right. Sure, you're replacing it with new rides here and there, but the lock stock bulk is still getting older. And that's a real challenge for operators. So that falls heavier into the space of operations and the technical team and the strategic factors that not all this impacts your guest experience. So I talk about the technical side. Like new rides, they're absolutely incredible. When you've got these software-driven systems, you've got AR, you've got VR overlays, you've got launch mechanics, animatronics, really elaborate theming, hydraulic systems, you've got mechanical and electrical systems. All of these things have to work not only in sync, but they've got to work safely. And there's always pressure to open on time, not just at the start of the season, but also on a daily basis. But delays happen. And that pressure is sometimes self-imposed as opposed to it coming down from the top. And that self-imposed drive or that pressure comes from wanting to be is a perfectionist attitude and mindset about trying to do the right thing and trying to be open on time. So when you talk about a new ride, in the final weeks of a brand new, let's call it a coaster coming in, you've still got painting, you've got rock work, you've got engineers trying to chase down glitches in your programming system. You're waiting on people. You need to get it signed off by various agencies. So there's a lot going on. Marketing's trying to promote the ride. Everybody wants a piece of that ride, and you can't sign off on the ride to open it, not just from a safety system perspective, but from a training system perspective. And your teams need adequate time on the ride. And every operator out there has different times that would designate as being competent. So how many hours are required for your operators? How many hours are required for your hosts on the ride? How many hours are required for your maintenance personnel? And they don't just need to know how to operate it. They need to know how to troubleshoot it. And they need to know what to do when a ride breaks down and what are all the different ways they break down. So when you look at certain systems, some things don't like rain, some things are okay in the rain, different rides operate in different weathers, different winds, et cetera, et cetera. Commissioning can be delayed if the ride manufacturer, well, if your third party signing off isn't happy with stuff, you've got to get your programming team back in, you've got to get the ride manufacturer back in, and you need to hold them there for quite a period of time. You've got really intensive software systems that run on as much code as they run on steel, and they're heavily automated and tied in with your augmented reality, your synchronized animatronics, all tied into those intricate ride control systems. You've got theming, you've got to make sure that theming is safe, that it fits the bill. No one's going to get hurt, injured on the stuff where the guests can touch it. If you're using an IP, you've got to make sure that the IP owner is happy with the way that everything has come out. So there's always constantly tweaks and adjustments, and particularly where you're using animatronics, things break, things stop working. And your maintenance team has to be able to work through a new ride. They've got to learn to master that ride, and there's often limitations depending on the timing of when a ride has been handed over. So I was used to working with new rides coming into the system with about anywhere from 4 to 5 years out. We'd start with the theory and the idea, and then as you started to hit around the 3 year mark, it became quite serious. And there's a lot of involvement from all the relevant teams, including the manufacturer. And it's funny how it gets towards the end and you feel like you're 3 months out and you still haven't got the ride, and it really starts to become quite a stressful thing. There are lots of hindrances, and particularly in the UK, you're up against weather and inclement weather. So if you've got a March opening or a late March, right, you're expecting to get the ride to you as an operator. somewhere in about January. But that means the technical team need to be into that space in November, December. If you've got snow on the ground, they can't be sending trains. They can't get the thing to turn. And they can't get it to turn if the programmer can't get it to turn to finalize the safety systems or the programming. Things stack up. And then if the maintenance team can't get away from where they are in their other schedule, simple little delays all start to compound on each other. And when it comes to training, you can get really broken training. So if a ride for some reason starts and you think you're getting the ride for a full day to start training on, and then it breaks down, you bring a whole team in. You can then find yourself, with only having 2 hours written on it, and then you've got to call the manufacturer back in to try and solve a problem because the technical team can't fix that. And you get this constant yaw going on, and you've got a really hard deadline. Now, you can always move the deadline, but sometimes the faults that you're working with aren't identifiable. Like you can't see the true nature of the problem because as you peel back, it's like a layer, an onion. As you're peeling away the layers, it reveals another fault, and then it reveals another fault, and then it reveals another fault. To time. I think some of the really big operators like your Disney's do this incredibly well with the lead times they have working with manufacturers, and they're pushing the boundaries of the art of what's possible. And I've seen examples where some operators have a manufacturer set up some of the times their rides and run them in remote locations, and then they'll repaint them, pack them back up, repaint them, and then bring them to site. And they've effectively ironed out the majority of the bugs. And it causes a lot of problems. So every ride is bespoke. Even if two coasters sort of share the same blueprint, no two installations are identical. You've got local factors from adjustment, climate, affect the setup and the maintenance. So you can't really rely easily on another park. So it's not like you can take, this car and then just make another one. These are all individual and they have their own quirks. And it's fascinating to see that.
You were there at the Wickerman launch, obviously. You were operations director around that time. And that was a launch which did get delayed because of weather. The opening day, me and Kit were both
Snow.
there on that day,
Yeah,
and
we
there was
were.
snow on the ground. What was that? Did that send you like running around like a headless chicken on that morning, going, oh my, everyone's expecting this ride at launch today, and I cannot open it?
Yes. I mean, the delays to rides are really challenging environments for management to work through because you're trying to judge how long the delay will be. And sometimes you're literally saying to yourself, how long is the piece of string? And depending on where you are in that lead time, I mean, if it's on that set, if it's within a day or two, it's generally it's challenging for your maintenance and your operating team. If it's a month out and you're talking about it being, or 2 months out and you're talking about delays, it has real financial implications, particularly for your marketing team. If you've gone and made a significant financial commitment, if you're talking 6 to 7 figure sums with TV advertising and you've booked that slot, you can't shift that. And you've made the ad, you've booked the slot, you're committed. And you can lose that commitment. So there's all sorts of challenges that come with delaying a ride and missing that mark. And finance steps into the picture too, and you consider the commercial aspects of the loss of revenue because you won't get the visitation you're expecting on that day. You get a lower visitation, which means all of the numbers that you built the return on the investment in is starting to become impacted day by day. Notwithstanding guest sentiment. Those who have booked staying in your hotels, made the commitment, booked time off work coming, all of a sudden that starts to change and you really get it's quite a negative environment from a consumer experience, let alone within the team. And once and so here becomes the next real major challenge. So your maintenance team is effectively focused on your winter maintenance and your seasonal resorts until you open. And then they become operators. Now they're doing the daily checks, the weekly checks, the monthly checks as they fall into that rhythm and that cycle. And so any winter maintenance that hasn't been completed doesn't get done at the same speed anymore because everybody's now operating. They fall into a different rota unless you've got dedicated resources everywhere. But that's quite costly. And so what happens is, I used to balance it like this, was a day in winter was like a day of winter maintenance was like 3 to 4 days when we were open. So things slowed down by 3 to 4 days. And so what could have been done in one day is now going to be 4 days before I can get a ride. And so there's this balance here as an operator where you're going, do I tell the maintenance team to keep that ride closed for an extra week so that I can get it, but I can get it with all of the units on it? So units is what we call the trains or your boats or your cars on the ride. Or do you get all the rides open but have really, really low capacity? Because I say forsake, the Wicker Man's got three trains, but you'll end up going out the door with two for the first week, before you can get the third or the month or whatever. And I've experienced that where I haven't had units for half a year because you just can't get back to it. You can't get your maintenance team back to it because it just gets away from you, particularly if there's challenges. So units, and there's this balancing game between, well, give it to me late, but give it to me with everything versus give it to me thin. I'll have everything open, but I'll have huge queues if I get the standard visitation you would expect on arrival. And everyone faces this. This isn't unique to my experience. It happens everywhere in that space. And it's a real balancing act,
So who would
Hopefully you
make the
don't
call on
quite
that?
challenge.
Who would make the call on that? Is that your decision and your decision alone, or do you have to go higher and say, right, this is your two options, which do you want me to do?
Well, it's more, it comes down to your strategic plan. You will have an understanding. So the way I used to work at Alton is I would set this up with our technical team and the marketing team, and I say, this is the approach I want to take. If you're working far enough ahead, you've got a sense and a feel for what's going to happen and how it's going to play out. And you can tell going in, you can basically tell half a year ahead where you're going to be and how it's going to play out. And you can give the team a steer on how you want it to cut and slice and dice it, I used to call it. How do you want to cut this one up? And then as you're getting closer, you'd start to make nuanced calls on specific rides. And then you're putting in your visitor mix, you balance your age groups and you're making calls on that, where to refocus it. And then you look around and say, how can we overcome that? You're constantly finding solutions to challenges to bring it all to the table. And sometimes you've got to call a ride out. What ride is that? And you never want to call any of them out, but sometimes you have to wear it hard. But yeah, that balance of units. So you may end up with all rides expecting to be open, but the next one becomes is how many units and trains do you have? And I think that's a really important thing, is the efficiency that happens for the maintenance teams over the winter is really critical. All of this happens before a ride ever opens a new ride. It's back in the design phase, is what can often set up the success of rides. And you think about how long it takes to train a ride maintenance team for them to become fully competent across the different components that are a ride. So you have your standard checks, like when you take your car in to be serviced, they'll do your 15,000, your 30,000, your 45. They're just standard checks. And then you'll have your big ones. You'll have your big service at call it the 30 mark, the 60 mark, the 90 mark, the 120 mark. And then you have minor services. That's your dailies, your weeklies, and your monthly checks that they do on the ride every single day. Where it starts to become more challenging for businesses is the reactive stuff. Now, the reactive stuff, when it breaks down, it's troubleshooting, fault finding. They generally are the more experienced hands on the ride. And then when you step out of that space, you've got your winter maintenance. And that's another set of procedures and challenges that before the maintenance team. And all of that. So when you're buying a ride, okay, let's pick a ride that you all know and you're familiar with, and we'll use the Wicker Man because we've touched on that one. So that has three trains. Okay, it runs effectively at its maximum throughput on three trains. We could have ordered four, and four trains would allow for us in the summer time when we're operating to actually start the winter strip on that fourth train. So that when we hit winter, one train's already done. In fact, not even one train's done. We can rotate those trains constantly through the year so that we're always got three trains ready to go. They're always ready with the strip. And so a winter strips are a real challenge, and we haven't touched on that yet. Stripping a train down is really quick and easy. Okay. It doesn't require a lot of technical skill. You bring it to the pieces. Okay. And you will have already ordered all of your consumables and your parts for that service on that train. and anything else you've identified but been able to keep it going. So like a plane, all right, a plane can take off but not have all the toilets working. All right, there's a critical level where they say the plane can't take off or a plane can take off. Rides are a little bit the same. You'll have a few niggles here, you have a few things that you need to fix. You'll have those parts ordered. You're waiting for winter to come along. Here we go. We've got the train in the garage, and you strip it down. And in the UK, you've sort of got this period where you finish up at about the end of October, start of November, and you're cranking open by somewhere in late March, mid to late March, right? That's a compressed time frame, okay? And let's say it takes you 2.5, 3 weeks. 3 weeks to strip down a train, all right? And you're working through each train. You're working through that, and you find a hairline fracture. You go through the NDT testing, and you find a hairline fracture. And you call it your manufacturer, you say, I need to replace this. Let's say I need to replace a wheel bogey. All right. And they go, we haven't got any of those in stock. It'll take 16 weeks. And now what's going to happen is that train doesn't come back, right, to you until right on opening. And then you've got to reassemble the whole thing. Now, you may only have it on just that one train, or you may find that it's on all the trains, in which case you're now staring at a completely different problem. So apart from the statement we had earlier where we talked about half a year out, you can start to see it. These are the nuances that start to affect you 3 or 4 months out. Now you're going, okay, now this is a bit of a problem. And you start to work through how can we accelerate? Where can I find spares? Where can I find copies? Is there another operator out there that our manufacturer can take them from, bring them over? But again, these rides are bespoke to each site and nuanced, and it's very hard sometimes. And they change these bits. So a lot of work goes into trying to solve this. And this is on relatively new rides, okay? And here's another one that really starts to tie up is, do you design a ride where you have the garage? Is the garage big enough to house enough cranes in there? Or you have to leave them, some of them in the station. Do you take them off to a workshop elsewhere? Do you do them in there? So how big is the workshop? And in some cases, I've seen examples where the way in which you disassemble a ride means that if you cannot put it back together, you can't actually get the ride off that part of the working track, which means you can't disassemble the rest of the you can only work on two of the four trains you have. And all of a sudden, therefore, you've got it's like having your garage, right? And you've got one bay full with a car that's in parts and you can't get it out. And so you've now got to work with one bay instead of two bays. And you've got the personnel to work on two bays, but you can't because now you've got a 16-week lead time on a part. And so I talk about the design phase prior to the installation of a ride can set about how everything goes. And if you've got the picture, I think, now, haven't you?
Absolutely. That's mad.
And so when we go back to and we look at the aged assets and we take in the age of rides, but that's notwithstanding things like critical spares. Having the right critical spares on site is always a challenge. Brand new rides give you some headaches in the first 3 to 4 weeks. There's no question of it. They give you some real challenges. They're tiny setups. And then after about 6 to 7 weeks, the real stuff starts to come to the surface. Right. In the UK, it's just like, that's like East. Oh my gosh. So
Like
there's this
now.
bit where you're going, oh my gosh, it's Easter. And you so there's some real pain in that space. And look, parts, stores, parts, having the right ones on hand, having them close at hand. And when we talk about the impact of guests, if you haven't got really great systems, you haven't really got great store systems, haven't got the working capital to carry enough parts, or you're constantly running around looking for parts. If it takes you 2 or 2.5 hours to find a part, that impacts the guest on a reactive maintenance piece. All right. And you're trying to solve a problem. And we've all stood there when a ride's gone down for 3 hours, okay? And if you've got new engineers in the workforce, they're sort of passengers. It's almost like master apprentice, right? They can't really do stuff. And if you've got to have stores people, and if you've got a storeman sick, and just all these things can conspire to it. So it's not just enough about having a full complement of maintenance team, it's the capability and the competency within that team at that time. And you've got electricians and you've got mechanics, and it's like, where are they at? And when we get into the older rides, we get into stuff that starts to bring about, like old cars. And I think we can all think of really interesting problems. All of us drive a car, and we've probably got a little nuance in the car that we all know individually, but if you gave the car to somebody else, they wouldn't know. Do you know what I mean? And sometimes that's born of time. Your maintenance team and your rides team sometimes know these nuances, but how well they've documented those processes, those idiosyncrasies, right? So when you get churn in your workforce, you can sometimes lose knowledge that you didn't know you didn't know you needed to know. And real things start to happen. And it's a bit like we're seeing a completely different change, from the old days when you used to get your car service and you go in and they'd fix stuff. Nowadays, it's like you just buy whole components. And as businesses change and improve their auditing and compliance on this continuous improvement, right? And when we talk about risk, we talk about liability. And so we want to get away from where we incur that risk, and we want to shift risk always, and liability. So what we say to ourselves, and this is how operators are doing it starting to today, is like, well, I want my manufacturer to provide me with the part, so I'll order the whole part. Right. So I have to wait for that part. Whereas in the past, I could fabricate that up. I could make a custom bracket. We could do that ourselves, or I could outsource it to a local workshop. You can't get the weld specs or the design specs from your manufacturer to get someone locally to make it. You may have to wait 12 or 16 weeks. And I've experienced that on rides that are working, where I was like, I can't open the ride because I'm not allowed to fabricate it. When you walk into workshops nowadays and you see lathes and stuff, it's like, we're not fitters and turners anymore. We order off the shelf and we install it and we plug it in and get the system to work. And so there's this transition going on between age rise, new rise, old hat maintenance teams, and new maintenance teams that have learned differently. And we see this in vehicle mechanics. We see this in many industries. We see that change occurring. So we're living through a change within the industry. And I really envy some of the new builds that are going on, particularly out in the Middle East, where they get to build from scratch a complete new theme park. It must be a godsend to have that with all the right systems in place. Like it'd be incredible. When you're carrying old rides, you've got parts obsolescence, right? Which becomes a real challenge, And when your manufacturer says, "Look, we can't support you anymore in that space. You need to go find your own stuff." That puts the risk back to you, and then you go, my gosh, and what works? And often, really long lead times, very hard to find stuff, outdated control systems, which are effectively the brain of the ride, and old systems don't like working with new hardware. Old software doesn't like working that out. Old analog controls and those early generation systems aren't compatible now with modern sensors, so you get stuck. And it's not uncommon to still find Windows 95 level software sometimes running,
I think
your
it's still running
DMX things.
Oblivion, isn't it? I'm sure someone who's done the Oblivion track walk said when they go around the ride control booth, someone said it's still running on Windows
Oh,
95.
look, and changing a ride control system's quite a daunting task for the engineering team. Like that, there's a lot of time, there's significant cost to a business to put a new control system into a major coaster. You're talking somewhere between, nowadays, I think you'd be between half to a million for a new control system for a ride. And each one has to be programmed. And it's you will end up with a season or an operating period of lots of little challenges while the system beds it in there and then makes small minor changes to the programming. So there's lots of stuff,
Does the guest feedback impact your operational decisions? If you say open the park and there's like two or three rides down, and sort of the members of the public seem to be shouting about one particular ride in particular, is that where you would then focus your attention, or do you have to sort of go, well, it probably doesn't make the most sense to be looking at that ride. We need to concentrate on this one. Obviously, social media gives people a voice to shout at you, and I just wondered how much that sort of alters your course that you've got.
I think the part here is to try and avoid being in that position in the first place. That's probably the biggest one. And it's as I said, half a year out, year out, half a year out, you sort of got a feel for How are you tracking? You know the capability, the competence of the team, you know new team members, you know what parts are running late from your supply chain. Then you're getting into the nitty-gritty of, well, that ride's down, we're going to lose one train, we're going to trade on two trains, not three, for the first 6 weeks because we can't get that extra bit, or that ride's going to be down. And then you've got the very small nuance piece, right? You know, the nitty-gritty granular detail of can't get open today, it's not going to be open for a couple of days, that sort of stuff. So you sort of know ahead. So communication is vital. That's absolutely key. Being able to, you've got to be able to foresee this and sort of head it off before it happens. And you've got to make a decision. I mean, we're in the business where consumer, I guess feedback is everything. All right. And you should be really steered from that. So it shouldn't be that you get yourself into that place so much and then you've got to bail yourself out. There is reactive stuff that happens on the day, right? There's nothing worse than a park experiencing multiple downtime across multiple rides simultaneously. And you don't need feedback to tell you what's happening out there. You know instantly it is not a great experience when that stuff happens. And you're more at risk at that, particularly at the start of the year. Okay. And there are other periods of the year where you're also at risk at that too, particularly when you get towards the end of the year. And temperature has an impact. It can play havoc with you. So look, in that space, you know, I think customers become used to how you react, particularly your repeat visitors. It's really important, but it's a tricky thing. A business is driven by I guess the experience, and you've the voice of the customer is paramount. You've got to hear that and how you manage that. Everyone does it differently. And how your staff handle that on the ground is one of the biggest challenges that I think any operator finds. You can come at it slightly differently. You know, you could say, a young team, right, has a ratio of, let's say, 10 staff to sort of one supervisor, and then a more experienced team with a bit more mileage has a ratio of about 15 staff to 15 frontline staff to, say, let's call it one supervisor. And a very experienced team with very little turnover runs a ratio of, let's say, 20 staff to one supervisor, because everyone sort of knows what they're doing. So why is that relevant? That's relevant because a very young team is so focused on safety, they sometimes forget the service component. Whereas a mature team that's been there, the safety stuff doesn't come to the surface. The guest experience and the guest recovery is paramount, because safety is always there. But a young team with very little experience, right? And if you've got that in your supervisory staff, they all default back into safety rather than reactive service management. And that's often where people don't want to hear you anymore, because they know the problem. They don't want to hear the stock standard cut paste message that the announcements make on the rise. They don't want to hear that out of the mouth of staff. They want something more tangible. I think that's when you start to get yourself in trouble, is when that's happening. So you take all of those steps I've talked about, year out, half year out, you know, all the way, you build it up in the moment. You've got to be able to foresee it, head it off. And if you haven't got an experienced team, well, you'll know that before you've got there. So you can read the tea leaves. A good operator should be able to read those tea leaves before they get into that space and be able to head that off.
Hearing Francis talk is just so fascinating. That's the end of part one of our chat with him. We spoke to him for so long, I couldn't even fit it all in one episode. But part two is coming next week, and he's still got so much to tell us. He's talking about how he managed his teams. We're going to talk about staggered ride openings and what the operational reasons are for doing that, if there are any. And of course, we've got to find out what his Just Gotta Ride It roller coaster is. That's all coming next week on Parkcast. If you haven't already, subscribe now so that you don't miss it as soon as it gets released. And if you do want to give us a like and a rating, that would really help. For now, though, we've been Parkcast.
Parkcast. The UK's original theme park podcast.